Welcome to the Players World Kitchen podcast, made in Wrexham and brought to you by Oscar Mayer, the Rugby Players Association and Brand Me. My name is Judith Batchelor and today I have the honour and privilege of talking with women's rugby legend Poppy Cleal about her journey and the challenges for women in the game of rugby, her World Cup experiences and life after rugby. There's a lot to talk about and before we start, for those of you who don't know Poppy and her incredible track record, she has made over 170 appearances for Saracens women, helping them win three premiership titles. She's earned 66 caps for the Red Roses since making her debut in 2016. During her international career, she's won multiple Six Nations Grand Slams and was named Six Nations Player of the Year in 2021. Poppy has also received the England Player of the Year Award and earned a spot in the World Rugby Dream Team. She is the second highest try scorer in the history of Premiership Women's Rugby. And before earning a Red Roses contract, she was a full-time prison officer. Well, welcome, Poppy. I am exhausted just reading all of that out. And I'm sure our listeners will be too. I mean, it is amazing. But how did it all start? Where was the love of rugby?
So I started playing rugby when I was 6 years old. And I just sort of never looked back since then. I was lucky enough to grow up in a house with a brother and identical twin sister, Bryony. And, you know, after school club, we started and we just never stopped. And rugby was something that when I was younger, I was always like, I want to do that forever. Just had so much passion and joy when I played rugby. And then I was lucky enough to turn it into a professional career and then, yeah, go on to achieve some of my dreams that I never thought I would.
Oh, the amazing, amazing track record. But I'm always curious at that moment, because when you're at school, you try lots of sports, don't you? But there's a moment when, I don't know, you either pick up a racket or a ball or a bat or something, and something clicks that A, you find out that you really enjoy it, and that you're quite good at it. I mean, did that happen right at the outset? Was it, you know, love at first sight?
100% it was love at first sight. I never realised I was, you know, that good at it or that I could make it into a professional career. But me and my sister were incredibly sporty. We did everything from hockey, football, netball, basketball, tennis, everything you could think of. I think we were our PE teachers' wildest dreams when we turned up and wanted to play in every team sport and do everything for the school. So it was always, like I said before, I always wanted to play rugby for, you know, as long as I possibly could. But, you know, it wasn't until I was probably turning 16, 17 when I played hockey on a Saturday for my local team and then playing rugby on a Sunday. And like the rugby team turned around and said, you've got to be serious about picking here. You've got to make a choice. So about 16, I had to make a choice if I was going to concentrate on rugby. And, you know, I had trials at Southampton for football and things like this. I never got in, so that probably told you how good a footballer I was. But I then had to choose, and I chose rugby just because everything that I am personally, so I was definitely needed to be in a team sport. I definitely, you know, needed to be in a team sport that I could be physical, I could be myself, and that's what rugby helped me be and let me be. So chose rugby and obviously never looked back, and it was one of the best decisions I made just to concentrate full-time on rugby.
Was it a difficult decision?
No, in the aspect of, it wasn't the decision to say I want to be a professional rugby player because that just wasn't an option. So when I was 16, you couldn't, you know, when they asked you at school, what do you want to be when you grow up? I couldn't turn around and say I want to be a professional rugby player because that wasn't an option for women back then. So it was always like, well, I want to do this so I can still play rugby at the weekends. You know, I didn't want a job where I had to work weekends because I still wanted to play rugby at the weekends. And I was like, don't really want to go do much education, but I want to go to uni so I can still play rugby and I can play Bucks rugby and I can do this rugby. So everything was about playing rugby. But it was just you didn't know that you could make an income from it or make any money. So back then it was just a decision to follow my hobby rather than follow my dream, if that makes sense. Yeah. And it wasn't until I was about 24 that turned into a professional career.
Contract.
And that I was part of the first squad to become professional rugby players in the whole of the world.
And how did that happen? I mean, because clearly you've got a job, you were a prison officer.
Yeah, just, you know, there was talks about it and some of the Sevens girls had gone sort of part-time and then they announced that England were going to be the first ever professional contracts full-time for 15 players. And I remember, I think there was only 28 contracts, not as many as there is now. And everyone was like, oh, who's going to get them? Who's not? And my coach said to me, Fergie said to me, it's between you and another player, and I've got to make the tough decision. I'm going to do it in a couple of months, but I'll let you know once I've made the decision. And
oh,
I,
wow.
Yeah, this other player, like, we got on really well, because I was like, oh, I feel bad for them, like, you know, or I'm gonna feel sad, but then happy for them. But if I get it and then they don't, I'm gonna be sad for them. And I was like, it's kind of a mix of emotions. But Fergie rang me and said, can I meet you in Bristol? And he walked me around the pitches at Bristol, and he was like, look, I've got something to tell you. And I was like, my heart was going dum, dum, dum. And he's like, you know, I'm going to award you this full-time contract. And I was like, oh, thank you so much, can't believe it, you know, straight on the phone to my mum. And then I remember thinking, oh no, I feel so bad for this other player that's obviously got this bad news. And I thought, how do you like bridge that? Because my friend, I was like, do you text them, do you ring them? So I was like, hey, you okay? She was like, yeah, good, you? And I was like, yeah, no, did you have a chat with Fergie? She went, yeah, I can't believe it, I got a full-time contract. And I was like, what? And anyway, we both got them, and I'll never forget Fergie for putting me through that. But yeah, so we both got them, and it was happy in the end.
Yeah, a fantastic story. And complete change of tack. I mean, tomorrow you're here in Wrexham with the Players World Kitchen. Tomorrow you're going to be cooking in the kitchen.
Yeah.
How do you feel about all of that?
Yeah, I'm excited to get going with my dish. So I'm sort of a creature of habit, let's say, when pre-match meal, I always have the same spaghetti bolognese, and I just love that. And so my dish is kind of maybe a little bit of a take on that. So I'm excited to do that and see if it can become my signature meal that I cook for myself every weekend.
So what are you going to be cooking for us?
It's egg fettuccine pasta, slow-cooked beef and Chianti ragu, Cavallero, roasted cherry tomatoes and Parmesan shavings.
Oh, I'm feeling quite hungry now just listening to
that. I know, it sounds good, doesn't it?
Beef ragu with Chianti. Well, I wish you the best of luck with all of that.
Thank you.
You talked about your story in rugby. We know why you're here cooking in the kitchen tomorrow. But in terms of your personal development and learning and, you know, basically thinking about how you prepare yourself for a world where perhaps you're not playing full-time rugby anymore, what's that look like for you?
Yeah, I think, you know, rugby was my whole identity. Like I said, since I was 6 years old, picking up the rugby ball, and, you know, I've never stopped. I was lucky enough to have so many great memories and rugby to take me across all the world and win many trophies and get many accolades. And then I'm going to have to give that up, and that won't be part of sort of who I am. So it's like hard to, you know, think of that, but it's a really exciting challenge, though, to sort of start a new career and a different career. So I'm kind of excited to start a 9-to-5, like something that gives me more structure, because being a full-time athlete, you get to rest a lot more. You get to be able to do the sort of things like having a lot more time cooking, making like nutritional meals and having time for yourself. But there's also a lot of free time. It's definitely less structured than like a normal job. And sometimes I kind of like miss that, and I'm like, oh, I really want that to help really spur me on and just create new challenges. So I'm kind of excited for that. I'm not excited for obviously having to gym 6 a.m. in the mornings now. Go back to the old school. Yeah. But we did that when I was, you know, a full-time prison officer, and I had to do rugby and be the prison officer. So, you know, we used to do that, and I have a good friend, Rocky Clark, and he used to say to me, you've got it so easy now. I used to have to pay for my first England kit.
So, is that right?
Yeah, and it's just crazy how you know, things turn around, and how now full-time athletes are so lucky that they can prioritize their sleep and their eating compared to people that used to have to pay for their England kit. So I'm excited for the new challenges, and it takes a lot of preparation, because people don't realise that, you know, you've lived and you've breathed rugby 24/7 for over 25 years. And now you've got to think about what do I want to do now? What's really going to make me passionate, and what's going to keep me motivated and keep me, you know, moving in the next journey? And as an elite athlete, you're kind of always striving for being the best. So, yeah, it's just deciding what I want to do next in my chapter.
But, you know, people always talk about the fact that a lot of the skills that you have as an elite sports person, you know, are transferable skills. And that's right, they are transferable skills. But so much of it is about attitude. And, you know, I often think that women, and Rocky's right, you know, it's better than it was, but it's still not as good as it should be in terms of the women's game. That as women, you have to be really resourceful, you have to be, you know, tenacious, gritty, determined. And those skills aren't going to leave you when you stop playing rugby. You're still going to be that person. So I'm sure whatever you turn your mind to, you will be successful at, because that's the kind of person that you are.
Well, hopefully, fingers crossed. But everything I've sort of learned in the professional aspect is from rugby, and rugby just taught me so much with regards to just how to approach different challenges, how to react to different challenges, and what happens to you, and you know, to make sure you're in control of certain things. And I've definitely changed from when I started playing to now, and that's just for all the experiences in rugby. It's literally nothing else, because like I said, yeah, all we've been doing is playing rugby. So yeah, it's an amazing sport, and I'm very privileged and happy to have had my career to achieve everything I have. But yeah, now's the bit that I go and crack on and sort of hopefully write some different chapter, but with different achievements.
And right now is a very exciting time for you, because you know we've got the World Cup in this country coming up. It's probably going to be the most viewed World Cup in the history of the competition. And you've experienced World Cups before. So I wonder, A, some of those past experiences that you could share with us. Yeah. That would be, I think, interesting for listeners. But also your hopes for this World Cup and what it will mean for the women's game.
Yeah, so I was actually reflecting the other day about the World Cups I've been to before, and I went to 2017 in Ireland. I was a last minute call up for an injury. Fergie did that to me as well that time. So the team had been selected. I'd been in the training squad and done all the pre-season with them. And, you know, the team comes out and they still have a week of training after the team comes out. And me and three other players were still there supporting the team, because it's, you know, it's easier to train with over 30 of you. So you can make two teams and you can play each other. So we're still there training. And I remember we had the little ceremony that they all got given, you know, a little gift from one of the sponsors. And we had to sit at the back and we didn't get the gift. And then as we were about to leave to go home, one of the coaches pulled us, all four of us, aside and said, guys, one of you is going to the World Cup. We just haven't decided yet. So stay by your phones this weekend and we'll ring one of you. And we all looked at each other like, what? And they said, yeah, someone's, you know, got injured today. They're not no longer going. It's a back. And I was a forward. So I was like, well, it ain't going to be me. And I had a good friend, McKenna. And I was like, oh, McKenna, like, could be you. Oh my God, like, you could be going to the World Cup. And that weekend, we're all there sat by our phones. And then I lived with Marley Packer. So she, you know, she's a legend.
Dangerous.
Yeah, that's dangerous. Party Packer, we call her. So she was packing her bag. And I was like, mate, I've got you this gift. Good luck. You're going to be amazing at the World Cup. And then Fergie rang me and said, Poppy, what are you doing tomorrow? And I was like, well, obviously nothing. I'm like probably driving Marley to the airport. And he was like, well, pack your bag. You're coming to the World Cup. And I screamed that house down. And it was, you know, I'm pretty sure Marley thought I'd burst a pipe or something. But she was so happy. Yeah. And then, yeah, managed to get to the World Cup in 2017. And a little fact that some people might not know is I actually played prop, second row and back row in the tournament. So I did play, I played three games and I played all three positions.
Three different positions.
Yeah. So again, that's another Fergie thing. He turned to me and he said, have you ever played prop before? And I was like, no. And he goes, well, if anyone asks you, you have, okay? Then I was lucky enough to go to the World Cup in New Zealand. That time I was just named in the squad, and that was amazing to be named. It was tough because me and my sister had been in the training squad, and then for her not to get selected, which to this day I still think was the wrong decision, and me to go, it was like sort of bittersweet. I was happy to go, but I just wanted my sister to sort of experience
all of that,
a World Cup, because it's just so special. But yeah, I was lucky enough to go to 2021, and I was played in the World Cup final, which was a sort of out of body experience, that final whistle when that went and we'd lost. And even to that last play and we kicked it to the corner.
I remember that vividly.
Yeah,
vividly.
Do you remember? I remember it too.
I thought we were going to win.
We all thought we were going to win. So we had the chance to kick the points, which was going to be a hard kick, to be fair, to draw, to take it to extra time. And we were like, no, kick the corner. And I thought, yeah, fair enough. Everyone's back in this decision. Let's go to the corner. Let's win this line out and we'll maul them over. And I thought, even if we don't maul them over, we'll get the penalty. And you're in such a panic station that we'll get the next penalty and it'll be a penalty try. And we walk off here with the trophy. And that lift happened. And then the ref reset the line out. So that was just a bit, you know, that doesn't really happen. Might happen at the start of a game. It doesn't happen at the end of the game. They kind of let things go more. So anyway, reset the line out and we ran the exact same line out. And I just knew then, when I looked up and that ball, the New Zealand girl got her hand in and that ball went to them, and then they just kicked it out. And then one of the girls next to me just started gagging. And I was like, wow, I've never seen anyone like their like body, like emotional response to that was just like to literally start gagging. And I was like, and then I turn around and there's someone else crying and someone else crying, and it's awful because you just knew that everything we'd been working for the last 5 years because of COVID, obviously it postponed it. And then we'd lost it, and then we had to watch the whole of Auckland prepare for their trophy parade the next day. Because obviously that night we go out and we enjoy it. Like, we go, right, let's all have a drink together. Let's make sure we still remember this, you know, this whole process, this whole journey. Because at the end of the day, we played in the World Cup final. We sold out Eden Park. We played in front of 40,000 people. Let's really enjoy this moment together. And then, you know, at 2 a.m. walking home, they're setting up the stage for the Black Ferns Trophy
Parade. Just to rub it in, yeah.
Yeah, and then on the flight home, you could watch the 24-hour plane home. You could watch movies, James Bond. You could watch, you know, BBC programmes, Luther. And then if you went turned to the sports channel, there was repeats of the Women's World Cup final.
Yeah, I bet. Just to make it even worse.
And then we were all like, as a pact, we were like, no one can put the game on. No one's watching the game on the plane home. But, you know, you couldn't tell the Bob and Jill two rows along that they weren't allowed to watch it. And then you'd look to the left and someone's watching the game on repeat next to you. Yeah, it was awful.
And hopes, you know, that this Rugby World Cup is going to be different again, isn't it? You know, the game's moved on in that time. And, you know, there's all sorts of things happening internationally in rugby. How do you see it playing out?
Well, they'll sell out Twickenham 100%. That final will be sold out, you know, and it's going to be incredible to have the World Cup in England again, selling out Twickenham. You know, the last time we had a World Cup at England, they sold out the Stoop, which, you know, is five times smaller than where we're going to fill out at Twickenham. And it's going to be incredible for a women's rugby team or just a women's sports team to sell out a massive stadium like that. You know, you last saw it in the Euros when Lionesses sold out Wembley. And I just think if we can have the same success that they did in this tournament, you know, we can really send women's rugby sort of skyrocketing. And I think that is a pressure that's on this Red Roses team and an expectation because, you know, like you mentioned earlier, where women have to achieve way more. If we want to, you know, send women's rugby higher and higher, we've got to win this premiership. Wow, I wish it was just as that easy. We've got to win. We've got to win this World Cup, and that takes pressure because it's your home World Cup. But if we do, you know, women's rugby in England and around the world will grow tenfold.
Yeah, I mean, and the game is already at that sort of pivotal moment, isn't it? Because you've got Premiership women's rugby doing great things. That fantastic campaign when it was launched with Powered Differently, which is really setting up the women's game as a very different game. And, you know, that's refreshing and very appealing to lots of people, actually. Because you will often get those questions about, isn't, you know, and I would never say this, of course, but isn't women's rugby, you know, just men's rugby, but not as good?
Because it's better. The beauty about, you know, women's sport and, you know, the football and the rugby, the netball, cricket, it's not trying to be like the men's. We don't watch the men's at the weekend and go, right, we want to be like that. We want to be our own brand. We're different athletes. We have different pros and different cons in what our bodies can do. And I think that's where, you know, women's sport is growing. It's because we're not trying to be like the men. We're not trying to pigeonhole and just, you know, not make the same errors they did. We're trying to grow differently, bigger, better, and we will make errors along the way, but it's just finding that space. And luckily enough, recently I went to watch the Six Nations and watched the Red Roses play and the girls play, and it's just a different vibe being in a crowd at a women's game rather than a men's game. Just the whole party atmosphere, the singing, the family ethos and just everything like that is completely different to going to go watch a men's game. And I don't think we should try and be any different. We shouldn't try and change that. We shouldn't try and make it to, you know, going to Twickenham where they joke that you'll go on the train to Twickenham for a men's game and everyone's wearing chinos and smart shoes and everyone looks the same. No, we want to be different like that. We want everybody can come watch. We want to be inclusive. We want a safe space. You know, sometimes things can get, you know, people can feel not so safe in men, you know, especially like men's football, etc., going to watch. I think that we want to make sure that we're our own space and that we can grow with that. And that's why I think that women's sport is so, it's got so much to go and grow, because we've got to find that sort of niche and where it fits.
And women's football has done that brilliantly. If you look at the audiences that go and watch women's football, and as you say, much more inclusive, much broader audience. And, you know, that's part of, you know, what Players World Kitchen is all about, is saying, actually, here you've got great rugby players, but actually they're just human beings like you and I, and they love their food and they love cooking because that's what fuels them and that's what helps their performance. And hopefully that appeals to a broader audience and brings the game to a broader audience. So just thinking about that and going back to food, you are a bit of a foodie, otherwise you wouldn't have volunteered to come along to the kitchen. But
yeah, no, I love my food. I love my food.
But when you're cooking for yourself and you're preparing food, what sorts of things do you cook? What do you like to eat?
I think it classes as a hobby. Definitely what my relationship is with food. I love going out eating at new places. I love eating different types of food. Like one of my favourites is Greek. Love Greek food. But if I'm at home and I was cooking, spaghetti bolognese, 100%. Roast dinner. Yeah, always love a roast dinner. And then I also like quick and easy things, and just doing it in different ways. So for breakfast, sort of sourdough, poached eggs, avocado, but then I'm partial to beans on toast with cheese on top. So, simple things like that, as well as, like Greek food, love Greek food, love Italian. So that's probably where my meal come that I'm going to be cooking. And just pastas, I think what I learned from being the rugby player and going through countless and hours of nutritionists coming in and speaking to us. And at the start, when I was like 18, I didn't really listen. Yeah. I remember one time someone told me that you could eat a whole block of cheese and it was good for you. I don't think that's right. But I remember taking that away with me. But, nutritionists come in year after year and didn't really resonate, or it was like, right, you've got to be this, you've got to do that. And it was really like, you have to. And that was just something that when I was that age, I was like, yeah, all right, whatever sort of thing. And as I grew older and matured, and the nutritionists, different ones came in and like, no, it's your choice. And I was like, okay, that sounds better to me. Like, it's my choice. Do I want to eat this or do I want to eat that? Yep. And is this going to make me a better rugby player or is that? And just how things sort of resonate more with different people. And it wasn't until later in my career that the sort of nutritionists came in and I felt they were speaking more to me rather than to everyone. And I found out that you're supposed to eat, I think it's like 10 grams of carbs when you're carb loading the night before a game. And I was like, surely not. That's a lot of carbs. Like, that's a whole bag of pasta. And no, it's true. You've got to eat so many carbs before a game, and it's mental. And that's what I say my love of pasta comes from. Yeah. Because I can eat so much pasta. I just find it like carbonara, spag bol, lasagna, pesto pasta. Amazing. Just love it all.
And I think you've touched on quite an interesting point, actually, around nutrition, because it's absolutely right. And the dishes you'll be cooking up and the recipes that you'll be looking at, we've looked at the protein, we've looked at the fiber, we've looked at the carbohydrates and, levels of salt and fat and everything else, because, those meals are going to help your performance. They're going to fuel your performance. But if all you ever think about is food as being a collection of nutrients, you've missed the whole point about the pleasure of food, which is, it's not just a collection of nutrients. It's something that makes you feel great. It's something that gives you pleasure. It's something that is quite sort of basic in our need as human beings to be well fed. And when you feel well fed and you feel, satisfied with a meal, and particularly a meal that you've enjoyed with friends. And again, one of the things tomorrow is that you'll be cooking and you'll have some of your colleagues and friends that will be tasting what you've produced. And
they say food is mood.
Absolutely.
That's what they say when we're at England camp, and we went to away to France and every meal was veal. And then we went to Italy and it was just like beige food in the hotels. This is not saying that French food and Italian food obviously is amazing. So, but we went away and it just wasn't that great. And then they realised it was sort of like the people's mood was changing, and they were like, right. So then they decided they'd take a chef out of us. And ever since then, the food has been amazing. And just everything, like the little details. And like I said about how important the day before a match day is, that's my favourite day because you can eat so much food and you get pudding. You get bread and butter pudding the night before and sticky toffee pudding because it's just crumble as well, because they just want you to get these carbs in, because there's no point eating carbs on the day that you're playing because
it's too late.
Yeah, it's too late. And the glycogen in your muscles, you need to be 100%. So yeah, it's just so many carbs. It's so much that we can't even eat it. You have to drink some of your carbs, and because nerves sometimes suppress your appetite, and we end up having just drink the carbs just to get them in. And because we know the next day we need them to be at the best and perform at our best, we need the carbs. And then there was even a study that the next day after a game, most people will go, right, day before a game, eat well. day of the game, eat well. And then the next day, oh, I'm not training today, I'm not playing today, so I don't need to eat as much. And there was a study that even on the day after a game, when your body's in recovery mode...
That recovery meal is important.
Yeah, so you know when you wake up and you've still got DOMS and your neck aches and this aches and you've worked really hard the day before, they did a study and it actually worked out that you burned the same, if not more, calories than you did the day before, because your body is just replenishing itself, and it's like repairing muscles, and to do that it needs calories. So yeah, they're my three favourite days.
And you just talked about nerves before a game. Tell me a bit about that. You know, you're going out, and whether it's for club or country, how do you feel before a game? I asked that because I know a rower who was a gold medal winner in the Olympics, who used to literally throw up over the side of the boat before the beginning of the race.
So it can affect people like that, so that, they do get nauseous. And like I said, with the suppressing your appetite, for me, I can never eat on a game day. I just had no appetite, couldn't swallow any food, even try half a banana, nothing. And quite a lot of the time, you have to wake up extra early, so you're not kind of thinking about game day. So you've got a game at like 3 p.m. What they'd do is they'd let you have the morning off, and you wouldn't really be into a meeting until like midday, or a team walk for about 11. So you've kind of got that morning to, and most of the girls get up, go for a coffee, make sure they have breakfast. But I'd have to get up really early, like 6, 7, in my room, just have a bowl of crunchy nut clusters just to get something inside me, so I'm not starving by game day. And then when it's just for game day, then I'll be having like carb gels and stuff, just because I just couldn't have appetite. And it was just the nerves that really played havoc with being able to eat on game day. But I was also fine the day before, so that's what I'm saying with the eating load, the food on the day. But yeah, and it's never like, I was always nervous at premiership level, but then that's sort of like, I got way more confident and more settled. But at England, I always had nerves, never didn't. And I was like, will this go away now? Because, you know, I've been here long enough, laced up my boots enough times to not be nervous. But no, every time nervous, even friendlies when there was nothing even on the line, still just really nervous playing for England.
And I suppose, you know, that's understandable and potentially a good thing. They say, you know, a bit of nerves is good, but because it's a big deal, isn't it? It's a big deal.
Yeah, and no, it's because it's just you dream and you've dreamt of playing for England. So when you get to go out there, it's just, you know, everything you've dreamt of, and those minutes, hours, days, months, everything you've put into it come into fruition. So it's you're always so proud, honoured, but you just want to make sure you do it justice, because you don't want to mess up. It's like a stage or something. You don't want to mess up your one chance to, this could be your last chance. You never know when your last game is, so you don't want to mess it up. And I think that's where the nerves come from, the pressure on yourself just to do good, to play well, and just to show why you've been picked to play for England.
And you say pressure on yourself, and is that the overriding pressure that you feel? It's your own.
Oh, and the coaches, oh yeah, they tell you when you've done something wrong. So yeah, I think it is knowing yourself, because you know what you can do. And I've come off pitches before and I'm like, oh, I didn't do that, or that I was rubbish at that. And you just don't want to come off feeling that. Like when you sit down at the end of the day and you take your kit off and back at the hotel, you want to be like, right, I like did myself proud today, and I added this to the team, or I helped this, or that went really well. You don't want to be sort of looking back and having regrets, and sometimes that's not in your control. Like I've been through games where I've really tried and just struggled to get into a game, or just wasn't really on it that day, and you're always like, why was that, how was that? And sometimes it's just, you know, it's not your day and you didn't get the rub of the green. But there, you know, you don't want to make that sort of a habit, and you want to look back and go, yeah, I did my best then. And
I left it all on the pitch, as
exactly.
They say.
I left it all on the pitch.
Obviously, we could talk about this, and particularly, you know, the upcoming World Cup for hours. But is there, you know, something that you just hope that's going to come out of this World Cup that will be a game changer?
I hope we get like our lionesses moment. So it just springboards some of the girls to be, you know, recognisable, that, you know, brands will work with us and just grow our game together, because it's easy for us, you know, to go out there and go, we're trying to grow the game. But we do need help in the aspect of, you know, working with some great brands, you know, in the sport, especially in the sport sort of avenue. You've got like Nike, Adidas, Castore, things like that. And it's just, can we all work together and grow the game? Because if we can grow the game, we'll reach more people, we'll get more girls involved in sport, we'll get more boys involved in sport, and then the sort of snowball effect. So, you know, I hope we get that sort of springboard, I think we've got to win the World Cup to do that, but the Red Roses team is more than capable to win this World Cup and drive the sport on. And I think that would be the legacy for the Red Roses. It wouldn't be, oh, they're three-time World Cup winners. There would be the Red Roses team of 2025 was a team that changed women's rugby.
Game changes.
Yeah, the game changes, exactly.
And I think what you're describing, that sort of virtuous circle, because if we get that great result, the audiences are there. If the audiences are there, the broadcast deals are there. The sponsors are there. The brands are there to really support the game. And once that starts, it genuinely is a virtuous circle. But you know, it's got to start somewhere.
So. I know, and you always say though, you know, in women's sports, you've got to achieve way more than men's sport to get even, you know, a small part of the recognition that the male counterparts get. That's something that, you know, is holding the women's sort of game and aspect back. And we don't sometimes recognise achievements as well as they do in the men's game. You know, there's some legends of the women's rugby game, some goats you might call them, and you know, you don't see them anymore. They kind of, the history of the game's not as celebrated as the men's, and I think that's something that needs to change, because a male player has gone through the same sort of career with the same achievements, you know, they're recognizable household names of the women's player who's then also had, you know, two kids, worked part-time as a police officer, and then played rugby for their country a hundred and, you know, so many times. People are like, who? You know, they're the answers on Pointless. So it's, you know, the history. That's one thing that I always think in women's sport can just be so much better, and just celebrating each other and the history of our game and the achievements. You know, I'm playing with multiple people now who have won, you know, more than five Grand Slams. You know, who does that? That's an incredible achievement. Yeah. But we're just like, oh, there's one there and there's another one there, you know, so it's an incredible feat. And I think, you know, maybe one day we can walk through like the, you know, the Rocky Clark gates at Twickenham or the Marley Packer stand.
Yeah. No, you're right, actually. And I do think women are much more conscious of that and conscious of the women who've been before them that have paved the way, mm-hmm. because, you know, they are pioneers and trailblazers that essentially did everything you described, you know, have a family, have a job, hold down multiple things, juggle lots of plates, and have managed to represent their country, and not just represent their country, but win Grand Slams and all the things that, you know, we all admire. But as you say, they're not household names. But I think we genuinely are at a pivotal moment in all of that. We're coming to near the end of our time together, but I just wondered whether there was something that you haven't talked about so far that you'd like to mention before the opportunity passes.
Oh, wow. I can mention anything I want.
Oh, yeah.
We haven't discussed puddings. No, I think I mentioned some few puddings in there. Well, probably just, you know, if anyone's listening and if they, you know, if I was to give any advice for any young girls or players coming up or young boys coming up, and when we spoke about at the start about how I got into sport and how I played every sport, rugby gave me so much in just every avenue of my memories, my teammates, my friends I have for life now, and every other sport I ever played in always benefited me, whether that was in my education or whether that was, you know, the relationship I built with people off field. So just get involved in as many sports, getting involved when you're a kid with, you know, netball, hockey, football, touch rugby, tag rugby, walking rugby, just everything, because sport gave me so much. And like, I could never give sport back what it gave to me. So yeah, my advice to any, you know, young kids growing up who wants to be a professional in anything, just make sure you try your hand at every sport, because sport's a great tool and something that I've used for my whole life.
Oh, that's really good advice. Really good advice. I've got one last question. So this is the sort of Desert Islands disc-esque in its nature. Okay. So you're just about to be marooned on a desert island. What three-course meal and what drink would you take with you to your desert island?
Okay, so the drink obviously has to be an espresso martini, which I don't think is good for a desert island, but that's what I'm taking with me. No one can tell me different. And then I think starter, probably going to go... Oh, that's so tricky. So starter's got to be fish. So I'm going to go calamari. And then for the starter, I'm going to have to go an Italian pasta. So I'm just going to stick with spag bol, but like a really... Like my mum's spag bol, you know? The homely, comforting spag bol. And, you know, when they put a bit of dark chocolate in to make it all rich.
I was going to say a rich
And then on the side has have garlic bread, cheesy garlic bread. And there's also a ratio of more sauce and spaghetti. Okay, because there's no dry spaghetti around here. And then for pudding, I have to go profiterole, so choux pastry, nice cream, filled with cream, no holes. And then chocolate on top.
Gosh.
There you go. Would you have that?
Probably not, but I like the sound of
it. Would you have that on a Sunday night?
I can't afford the calories. I don't get the exercise that you get. I have to be a lot more careful. But no, I am so grateful that you've joined us here today. I can't tell you. You're an absolute star role model. And as I said at the beginning, what a wonderful track record. And wish you the very, very best of luck in the months to come. So it's time to leave the discussion. I hope you've enjoyed today's discussion with Poppy Cleal. And we hope that you'll join us in a week's time to hear from our next cooking guest. Until then, goodbye from both of us from Wrexham.